is the sixth case, News Source versus Belvedere National Bank. Ms. Leiter.
May it please the court and counsel. Good morning. My name is Lisa Letier, and I represent the plaintiff appellant Margaret Leibforth in the matter of Margaret Leibforth versus the Belvedere National Bank. The issue before this honorable court today is whether or not the district court's entry of summary judgment in favor of the defendants on July 30th of 2002 constituted reversible error, and it is the plaintiff's position that it did. This case is about age and sex discrimination in the employment context. And it is about the demotion and the subsequent termination of Margaret M. Leibforth in 1998. Her demotion occurred and her termination occurred nearly 1 year after she had been promoted to the assistant vice president and branch manager of the Kirkland Belvedere branch group. This is a woman who had worked her way up from teller to branch manager, 18 and a half years of employment with the same defendant. She had an exemplary employment record. She had immersed herself in training, banking principles, got involved in the community, taught banking, obtained a degree, a 2-year degree in banking from the prestigious Illinois Banking School. She was, by the testimony of the defendants, a valuable employee, in fact. And in fact, it is the defendants themselves who admit that they did not demote or terminate her because of job performance. So why did they? It's our contention they did because when she turned age 55, being the loyal employee that she was on or about May of 1998, she informed her new supervisor, Mr. Larson, that her husband was thinking of retiring, that they had just placed their home up for sale, and she didn't want her employer to drive by her home in the small community and wonder what was going on, so she explained. They have a Christmas tree farm, it's an unusual property. The light property across the street took 2 years to sell. This was somebody who was invested in her job and invested in the community and wanted to ensure that her employer knew that she was still the same loyal employee that she had always been. But instead of appreciating that loyalty...
Well, but it was pretty much understood that she was off to Arizona after the house sold, wasn't it?
No,
that's
not...
the way you really would look at the incident.
I wouldn't agree that that was actually understood by all the parties that were involved. And what
the only party that really has to understand is the defendant in this case, because it's his motivation that's at stake.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the defendant...
If she has... given an ambiguous statement that indicates to him, or at least so to cause him to believe, that she's going to haul off as soon as the house is sold and go to Arizona, he's home free, whatever he has.
And if that were the situation, I wouldn't be here, because she didn't give an ambiguous statement. She
she gave him the impression that that was it. It's not an ambiguous sort of thing. It's what impression he had.
Well,
what did she say that would cause normal people to believe that she's saying, listen, as soon as I sell a house, I'm out of here?
Well, that's not what was said, in fact. And the defendants themselves contradict each other as to what was said and when it was said. And the problem that we have with this chronology of events that started in May and who said what at what time, what statements she admits she made, what statements she denies that defendants assert, is that the district court, respectfully, appears to have simply glossed over all of these facts, ignored certain relevant facts, such as the affidavit of a John Murphy, who was a co-employee with the plaintiff, an individual who indicated that everyone at the bank knew she did not intend to retire. She didn't want to leave. She needed her job. She protested repeatedly, I'm not leaving.
Well, then why would she ever make the statement, I won't be retiring to the house? So why would she raise the subject of retirement at all?
Well, she only raised the subject of her husband's retirement. The fact that he was considering taking
and
an early retirement.
And she did not say she wouldn't be retiring until her house was sold? She didn't.
When she was questioned as to whether or not it was her intention to retire, she said, well, I mean, I'm not even going to consider retirement until the house is sold. And at that time, when we sell the house, I will give you notice within 30 days as to whether or not we're going to leave the area. She didn't say, I'll give you 30 days notice and I'm leaving the area. She said, I will let you know if we're going to leave the area. Her husband was still working in May of 1998. The district court's order indicates that it is uncontested that in May of 1998, she told Mr. Larson that she was leaving. That's simply not accurate. It's simply not true, and it's not supported by the record that was before the district court at that time. In fact, just the opposite. There are 32 triable issues of fact, which we have recited in our brief, and I know that Your Honors have read the brief and have noted that we made numerous citations to the record to support each and every one of these triable issues of fact, which the district court either ignored, construed in a manner more favorable to the moving party as opposed to the plaintiff, resolved ambiguities in favor of the moving party, committed at least one instance of plain error where it indicates that it is uncontradicted that in May 1998, Mr. Larson indicated to the plaintiff that he would be replacing her because of her imminent plans to retire. That is not an uncontradicted fact. Just the opposite. That is one of the key and central facts that we have been arguing over since 1998, whether or not she said she was going to retire or Earl said it. Mr. Murphy, a co-employee, a disinterested third party, in an affidavit in the record, indicates she never said she was retiring. We all knew it was Earl that was considering retiring. In fact, after they fired her, she still didn't retire. She was still looking for work. She hadn't retired by the time her deposition took place 2 years later.
I have a hard time seeing where the age or gender discrimination is here, even if it's true.
Well,
I mean, what if this was, if she's a man and she, that's out, you know, putting the house up for sale and
well, Your Honor,
is retiring or what happened?
Is she a man that has, and I'm in my rebuttal time right now, but is she a man who's over the age of 40?
Sure.
Just like Mr. Murphy, who was also told, by the way, December 30th, today's your last day of employment, and they replaced him with a substantially younger employee with less seniority. She was in a protected class. She had been performing her job duties according to her employer's expectations. They had no reason.
So that's what, they didn't change her rate of pay?
That's
they changed
correct.
Her title.
But a materially adverse employment action does not necessarily involve just one, arguably.
Our case law, it's pretty difficult to establish an adverse employment action that has no diminution of pay.
Well,
unless you're in some academic setting or something.
It is true that there are other indices that can be particular or relevant to that situation that the court has looked at in the past. Namely, she lost all supervisory authority. She no longer attended management meetings. She no longer reported to the vice president of the bank. She reported to the man who replaced her. She did more menial tasks. She also capped out at her current salary as an assistant, whereas when she was the branch manager, she had the ability to earn more money. So while there may not have been a cut in pay, and the employer's own employee handbook indicates that demotion does not necessarily mean you'll have a cut in pay, which is another fact that the district court ignored, along with the incidents of pretext.
Your opponent suggests that there was a failure to respond to the bank's 56-1 statement, which states, this is that Metz informed the plaintiff at the May 28th meeting of his plan to hire someone for her position as a branch manager, assistant vice president, due to the plaintiff's intent to leave Philadelphia Bank's employment when the house was sold. They said there was no response to that, and the district court correctly admitted that as an uncontested fact. Is that true? There was no response to that?
It is not accurate. What you'll note in our response...
What part's not accurate?
I'm going to tell you right now.
Okay.
Paragraph 33H is the paragraph that they're addressing.
Yes.
And you will note when you look in our response to their statement of material facts that it was an error, it was a mistake, that 33H is not there. But what you will see is a general denial of the defendant's recitation of what occurred during that meeting, namely that she told him she was leaving, she was going to retire, and she just refused to set a date. If you look at the first paragraph in paragraph 33, and you'll see it attached to the appendices as well, there's a general denial. We admit certain things happened, and we deny the rest, and then I broke it down specifically. But you are correct that 33H, that numbering, is not there, but the denial of the allegations is there in general form. I'm way out of time. There's so much more to say, but if I may just briefly ask that the court reverse the district court's ruling. There are numerous recitations of error, failures to consider material issues of fact, failure to apply to the standard. We ask that it be reversed and remanded to the trial.
Thank you. Mr. Benson?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Joshua Vincent. I represent the defendant Belvedere National Bank in this case. As I was preparing for the argument and finished reading the briefs, the first question that popped into my mind and that Ms. Sotir mentioned at the beginning is, why would Mr. Metz, the CEO of this bank, promote the plaintiff to the assistant vice president branch manager position in 1997 only to turn around within the span of less than a year's time and fire her from that position? Did he suddenly develop an aversion to females in the protected class? No, I don't think so, and there's case law in this circuit that makes that plain. That type of underpinning of the whole case, it's counterintuitive. It doesn't make any sense. You don't promote somebody to the position of assistant VP branch manager just so you can terminate them for age-related reasons within the same year when they're in the protected class in both time periods. It doesn't make any sense. And Judge Reinhard recognized that immediately in this case, and he pinpointed the problem, which Judge Fromm pointed out right there, is that paragraph 33H. Because paragraph 33H of the 56.1 statement made it pretty clear that Mr. Metz, the president of the bank, told the plaintiff that he intended to replace her because she was selling her house and was leaving the bank to move to Arizona. Now, that was his belief. Now, there, from the standpoint of pretext, which seems to be what most of these employment cases all boil down to in the final analysis, there is no evidence in this record at all, and Ms. Letier has cited none, that draws into question Mr. Metz's basis for believing that the plaintiff was going to leave the bank as soon as her house sold and move to Arizona. Nothing that draws that into question. In fact, the evidence in this case is wholly consistent with that belief. First, as Ms. Letier acknowledged, they admitted the 33H paragraph. Second, if you look at the plaintiff's EEOC charge filed after this whole event occurred, she said she denied
that she had a general denial of when the events that occurred that are described in that paragraph.
I would disagree with the characterization of the
general denial.
Yeah, of how she's characterizing the 56.1. The 56.1 is paragraph by paragraph, fact by fact, with citation by citation. And under the local rules, she is obligated, the plaintiff is obligated, to make a point by point response to that. I mean, you cannot come in and just make a general denial without addressing each of the facts and citing specifically from the record the facts that support your denial and create the question of fact. And I think Judge Reinhard was well within his authority in finding that that was an admission. But even if you were to put that aside, the evidence is really overwhelming with respect to the fact that this was a good faith belief held by the president of the bank. If you look at the plaintiff's EEOC charge that was filed in January 1999, she said in it, quote, that she was terminated due to plan to leave bank when house sold. So this is even after she's been terminated. She's making a sworn admission in her EEOC charge that that's why she was terminated, which is consistent with the bank president's belief. This was repeated in another memo that the plaintiff wrote in August of 1998, where she again indicated that she was leaving the bank 30 days after her house sold. When you turn and you look at what's the bank's conduct, and the plaintiff tries to make a big deal out of how the bank engaged in some type of inconsistent conduct, it's a totally inaccurate characterization of the record. The bank's conduct was entirely consistent with its belief that she was going to sell that house, retire, and move to Arizona. They immediately posted her job in May of 1998 after she made this announcement. The plaintiff took no action with respect to that. They immediately made an announcement to the board of directors that the plaintiff was retiring and moving to Arizona. The plaintiff received a copy of the minutes of that officer's meeting, took no action to correct it. The bank went ahead and interviews people both internally and externally in June of 1998. The plaintiff is well aware of that, takes no steps to correct it. They hire Scott Drexler in July of 1998. The plaintiff is well aware of his hiring, and she's told that she's being replaced. She takes no steps to correct this. She is, the position of the branch manager of the bank is specifically upgraded during this period by the bank's hierarchy because Scott Drexler happens to have a degree in farm management. He happens to also have a degree in business management, fits with this rural bank's lending profile to farms in the community. So they upgrade the position, they increase the salary. And finally, we come to August of 1998, where the bank's president and vice president sit down with plaintiffs. And they say, okay, Scott's in place. What are you doing? When are you retiring? And this is really what the crux of this case is about. Because it's at this point that the plaintiff wants it her way. She wants it to be, I will leave the bank 30 days after my house sells, whenever that may be. And that's what she writes in that August 28th memo. But that's not what the bank wants. The bank is now in a position where they're paying two people as branch managers. And they don't want a situation where they're going to be waiting indefinitely and paying two salaries waiting for plaintiff's house to sell. So from a business perspective, the bank is perfectly within its rights, consistent with the president's belief from the outset, to terminate her and tell her, look, either you pick a date when you're going to retire, or we're going to pick the date for you. And she refused to pick a date, so the bank picked the date. And the date the bank picked was December 31st of 98. Frankly, a pretty generous position by the bank, because it allowed the plaintiff another 4 months to remain at the bank, to qualify for her 401k for that particular year, to qualify for her profit sharing for that particular year. They could have told her she was out of there in 30 days, but they did not. And that's really what the heart of this dispute is about. Sure, the plaintiff was an 18-year bank employee, and I think the plaintiff felt that having spent 18 years at the bank, she should be able to dictate when she was going to leave and make a contingent on the sale of her house. But the bank's got a business to run, and the bank did not see it that way, and that's why they told her, you either pick a date or we're going to pick the date for you. There was no adverse employment action taken against her. Her salary remained the same. Most of the employees still reported to her. She was there to train her replacement. She suffered no adverse employment consequences at all. The big thing that the plaintiff seems to point to in this case is that this bank made some horrible mistake, that this was all an error. They misunderstood what she said. She never intended to sell the house and retire immediately. But there's three problems with that. One, just by making that argument, plaintiff admits that the bank held a contrary belief, and that's all that matters for purposes of the employment litigation. Second, the bank's error, if it made an error, and I don't think they did, but even if they made an error, that's not actionable. So the fact that there may have been some misunderstanding makes no difference in this case. And third, she really didn't do anything to correct the error, even if it existed. And I don't think she, you know, that makes any difference legally in this case. But from a factual standpoint, Ms. Lapierre keeps making this point that everybody got it wrong and the plaintiff kept protesting. Take a look at pages 85 and 86 of the plaintiff's deposition. She says she didn't talk to anybody about the supposed error when this all was happening. Now, she does deny that later on in an affidavit filed 2 years after her deposition, which is what I think Ms. Lapierre is basing these comments on, but we all know that once you make a statement in your deposition, you can't come back with an affidavit and try and contradict it. And that's exactly what the plaintiffs are relying upon to try and manufacture some fact question over a mistake that doesn't make any legal difference in this case whatsoever. So unless the panel has any questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Spencer. Mr. Lettier, your time has expired. You may have a minute.
Is this your watch? Somebody left their watch up here. Is that yours? Oh, okay.
The problem with counsel's argument is that it does just what the district court did. It makes assumptions without looking at the totality of the record, without looking at the fact that later on in the very same deposition, she indicates that the exact opposite of what counsel raised. The bank raised four business necessity defenses as to why it was that they were taking this action against her. Four times, they changed their story. First it was, she said she was going to retire. When she denied that, and she did more than just protest to one person, she hired me, who sent the bank a letter. She told the foundation members she was going to sue if they insisted on her leaving. There's a memo of September 11th, 1998, between Scott Drexler and Mr. Metz, informing him she's going to sue us if he forced her out. Yet they continue to amazingly claim they had no idea she didn't intend to retire. When that didn't work, they said they couldn't afford two salaries. Yet they hired Rose Salinger after she left, a woman substantially younger, at least 10 years, presumptively younger, to replace her in the same position. They indicated that she had less qualifications, yet Scott Drexler does. And it goes on and on and on. You must look at the entire facts, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, court. Case taken under advisement. Court will stand in recess.